Okay, hi everyone. Thanks for coming. So, first, is there anyone that has an announcement for the rest of us? Good. Okay, I have one announcement. The barbecue today, right at 6:30 p.m. So we're still trying the format, what works best. If you want, I said right, I'm going to supermarket so I can buy some shared stuff. If you're interested, send me an email by. It was by noon, but some people told me afternoon, so you can send me by, I don't know, 3:30 or something like this, before I go to supermarket. Great.
We need social coordinator.
And we need a social coordinator, which is, I'm doing this week, but I'm away next week, so we need someone. So think about it, please. Okay, and what we want to do today is just to decide which hard question we're going to solve in the program, right? And once we decide, then right, it's clear that we're going to do it. And it's recorded, right? So we have to. So these are the topics that I mentioned last time, right? So it's like five topics, and they're not very well defined, but it's just to get things started. And you can either suggest one of these topics an open question, or you can just suggest an open question that has nothing to do with them. It's fine too.
And then one more thing, going to Friday, we still don't have any specific plan, so if it looks like we're sort of in the middle of things by the cookie time, we can continue on Friday, or if it looks like we're converging to a set of, you know, topics that we can break off in working groups, we can do one of those on Friday. That's all up to us, depending on how we go now.
Yeah.
We can sort of try to stick to some order so that we have, well,
right.
if possible.
Yes. So who wants to start? Who has a nice problem to share? Yes, Daniel?
So this is based on a discussion I had yesterday with Chris Laumann and somebody from the Intertwiners programs. So in these computationally hard Hamiltonian systems that I think Toby mentioned, they're kind of constructed so that we know what the ground state is and the properties the ground state has. So I think it's a very interesting question to ask, what are the more excited states look like, the spectrum, and in particular, what's their behavior at finite temperature? This is, I should say, both the classical and the quantum ones.
And how much is known so far?
Basically nothing.
Excited states and thermal states?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, so I guess it's not just a question about complexity, but in fact, it's more about the spectrum and whether these are actually glassy at finite temperature, which I would assume, but don't know, things like that.
But you mean, what do you mean the spectrum, like understand the spectrum of these fermi hard models?
Understand the spectrum and the behavior as a physical system, I would say.
But of these hard instances that we identify.
Hard instances, yeah, that's right.
And what are the sort of challenges? It's not been developed for mostly.
I'm not sure that anybody's looked at it very seriously. Part of it is just that they're very complicated systems. I mean, the Hamiltonians that you write down. I mean. Some of our constructions had, you know, like 1,000 state particles making up the system or more. And like I said, they're designed so that we know about the ground state and anything else. You know, you just want to bound the excited states that they're not. But beyond that, you know, kind of we knew nothing and didn't put any constraints on them. And so, I mean. You know stuff about them, so you could certainly start to analyze this, but I don't think anybody's really tried.
So then it sounds like the thermal state would be the next easiest because it's the other end of.
No, not necessarily. I mean, I'm imagining low temperature thermal states.
Okay.
High temperature, yeah, I don't think high temperature is meaningful actually. I mean, it's just kind of arbitrary. That's going to be. You know, some artifact of the details of how you constructed the system, right? You could have put some cutoffs and something, and it would be totally different high energy states. Low energy states are constructed in such a way that, you know, there's a ground state that's the solution to some computationally hard problem. And the excited states are things that have to be similar to that in various ways, right? And so those are the ones that have some kind of structure that I think is related to the actual problem rather than just details.
In one dimension, it's interesting because for thermal states, there is a matrix product operator representation of them, where the bond dimension scales exponentially with 1 over temperature. So at finite temperature, they're always easy, right? You can always...
That's in one dimension.
In one dimension, exactly. But like you have this hardness in one dimension, right? So
yeah.
So there, I don't know what would be the temperature for which it becomes hard, right? It has to scale with system size, but it's like log n or is, you know, linear in n, right? That's... we know we need at least log n, right? Because if not, it's easy, right?
Right, and we know...
So there is this transition that we don't know.
Probably know that if it's polynomially small.
Then we know, because then we have this bound on the gap, which is like one of the poly,
right? Yeah, you have to look at the degeneracy as well, but
the ground state is unique, or no? It's usually
the ground state might be unique if you. Well, it depends. I mean, for QMA, we don't know, right? That's unique.
But, for unique QMA.
But certainly we could make up instances that could be hard in some sense that yes. Unique ground state. But the excited states, we don't really know the degeneracy because you have many witnesses.
That's true. But then we don't care if, because we have this 1 over poly n gap in the Hamiltonian, if the temperature is a bigger polynomial, then it's just, right, it's fine. You are in the ground state already. Right, because they're exponentially made at most, but you have this e to the minus beta, right, e, and then. So
yeah, it could be some polynomial.
Yeah, for polynomial it's fine, but for constant is easy, right? So polynomial is hard. Constant temperature is easy.
Right.
In between the low.
But like I said, I think this is also an interesting question for even like the classical cases in 2D.
Right.
And what you were saying is for 1D.
1D. 1D. Yeah, it doesn't work for 2D.
And sorry, the matrix product thing is not just a representation, but it's easy to find with thermal.
You can actually easy to find. Yes, it's when you show it simply.
But again, I'm not primarily interested in the complexity, although that's an interesting question, but in the physics.
So people who study spin glass, they must study this classical version, right, in two dimensions or more, right?
No, nope. I mean, they study spin glasses. Usually, they study, you know, some kind of random thing, and frequently not even in finite dimensions, but sometimes.
Because I
don't know a lot about that.
Okay.
There's a recent archive paper by Elizabeth Croissant and Johannes Bausch where they got somewhere. I think for the original Kitaev construction, they have a handle on the spectrum. I think.
Okay.
Or at least some handle on the spectrum.
That one's a lot simpler.
Yeah.
than the later constructions.
And even for that, it's not simple.
But
that might be a starting point. Because the more complex constructions you analyze by somehow bringing it back to that.
Yeah.
Good. Yeah, I think that's an interesting question. Who else has a possible question? Yes,
characterizing mixed state entanglement relevant to condensed matter systems.
Understand mixed state entanglement in condensed matter systems.
Yeah. Uh-huh. How do you? It's not directly related, but just you often deal with mixed states. And
yes.
It's a obviously old question. How to characterize quantum correlations in it? And
So like you have, for example, the thermal state of a many body Hamiltonian, and you want to compute some mixed state entanglement measure, there is no way to do that?
Yeah, are there better measures than, say, negativity?
Which
still, I mean, there's, on the one end, you have much harder things like entanglement formation, distillation, which are really hard to calculate, but negativity maybe is not good enough. Is there something in between which is really...
Yeah, a related interesting question that I think, but is like for these many body states, we have these tensor networks, right? They are very useful for description of this state, but they are not, at least we don't know how to explore them to compute like mixed state entanglement measures there, right?
Right.
So they don't fit together with like negatives or this other. So it'd be interesting if there is a way to do, right, to explore the nice structure of tensor networks, but to compute some measure of entanglement. For like pure state, it's fine, right? Because, that's the whole point, but for mixed state, it's not, right? For matrix power operator, we don't know how to do that. So.
And also, recently, there's some paper in there claims that using in ADS CFT, I mean, in holographic systems, you can probably estimate or calculate entanglement distillation, which sounds like a very big, I mean, if it's correct, that's a very interesting result.
For mixed states, you can compute the syllable entanglement. That's
yeah,
what they
for, say. For systems, you have holographic dual. This is taught by Taki and Agi. At least, I don't know whether it's a conjecture. I'm not in the field, but there's a paper recently. It sounded very interesting.
Does anyone know from
holographers
here?
Ning knows about it. And I think even I've seen it, I'm sure. It's a recent paper.
Takanagi, okay.
And I forgot the second author.
I see. That sounds interesting. I don't know. Okay.
Yeah, because these are highly correlated states, and they're asking quantum correlation in the thermal state. That sounds very interesting.
Yes.
So related to this, I mean, apart from measures of entanglement based on bipartitions, I guess it would be nice to figure out what is the status of measures of entanglement for multipartite systems. Are there, can one be defined?
Well, many have been defined, but the question is which ones are actually useful, right? And
then in the context of holography, whether any of these things are somehow relevant.
I see. So like relevance of multi-particle entanglement in holography, right? I think that's not very explored. Right?
That's it.
Okay.
Question. So I think another related question is that why measures of entanglement are relevant in the context of many-body systems or conscious matter at all? Because the main property of these measures of entanglement, like negativity that Tara mentioned, is that they are non-increasing under classical communication and local operations. And so you may ask why this non-increasing, being non-increasing, this is a property that distinguishes them from, let's say, mutual information. So you may ask why being non-increasing under classical communication be relevant in a many-body system at all.
So like the role of LOCC, why?
I mean, maybe they're not, and it's just a proxy for some other better resource.
Exactly, that could be true. So, for example, many times people talk about entanglement entropy, but entanglement entropy for pure state, you can also think about just mutual information. For the end of the reason that maybe mutual information is just a relevant quantity.
Shannon entropy itself.
Shannon
entropy itself.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, but that's a measure of entanglement for pure state.
Right. So, is it most natural generalization? Maybe that's. I mean, this other meaning beyond the resource theoretic viewpoint might be the thing that's more at the heart of why entanglement entropy crops up. I mean, identical question you can ask in the context of holography as well. Why should it be? I mean, from the quantum field theory standpoint, I think LOCCs are also. I don't see what is the role of LOCC. There isn't much role. Link there, and yet entanglement entropy also seems to be very.
So, for example, as Daniel mentioned, it could be just a relevant quantity. It's another resource. These days, for example, people study a lot of coherence as a measure. So maybe that's the relevant thing to study.
Actually, on the resource theory theme, it seems, I mean, how robust or how universal is this sort of framework, for example, could one apply it to various other things? You might think that you could rephrase, you know, any action principle, let's say.
Yes.
Or theoretic viewpoint. And it sounds like a toolkit that's not been really that widely applied.
There is a big thought related to that might be interesting to many people here. Like, can a specific instance of what you ask, can we phrase parameterization theory as a resource theory, right? Because there are many of the things that we want in resource theories, like we want a set of states which is preserved under the operations. This would be CFTs, right? We want a set of operations, these are the parameterization flow. But does it make sense, right? So that's, I don't know where to put that. Maybe get there.
That's engineering.
Since you asked, maybe, right, that's it.
Well, I'm interested in
all. Yes, okay. Anyone else? John?
Yes. So under column 4, I would like to understand more precisely the sense in which conformal field theory can be regarded as a approximate quantum error correcting code. And I have something specific in mind. In fault tolerance, we have the Easton-Knill theorem, and it says that we can't perform arbitrary rotations on the code space, unitaries preserving the code space, which can be decomposed as a tensor product of unitaries where each factor acts on some erasable subset of the physical qubits. But in the CFT, there's a local Hamiltonian. And so one needs to understand how that dynamics, which is local on the boundary, gives rise to bulk dynamics in the code space. And so I think probably one needs a notion of an approximate Easton-Knill theorem. And there's a useful hint in a recent paper just last week by Hayden et al., where they discuss related issues, something actually more general than Easton-Knill, but in particular, their result shows that we can violate this Easton-Knill theorem when the code space is infinite dimensional. And so that suggests that, you know, as the dimension increases, there should be some sense in which we're approximately realizing unitaries on the code space as a product of unitaries acting on small subsets of the boundary. So I think it's be useful to see how all these things fit together.
What is the result? So they have an infinite dimensional space, and then they can, in quantum information language, they can do transversal gates, universal transversal gates. Mm-hmm. So I have an example of that.
Yeah, well, it turns out to be pretty simple.
Can you tell us? Or
well, so they frame it as the problem of what they call a covariant quantum error correction. So the idea is there's some group, could be finite group, could be a Lie group, and we would like to realize, we'd like to have an encoder such that a unitary acting on the state to be encoded can be expressed as, after encoding, a product of unitaries, you know, acting on subsystems in the code block. So, you know, Easton-Knill is an example of that, where the Lie group is the full unitary group on the code space. And they consider it specifically in the context of how do I send a reference frame to you? You know, if I want to send you a qubit and we have no shared reference frame, you know, you would like to be able to decode it in the way I intended. So I got to send you enough information so you can reconstruct the reference frame. And essentially, I can send you a classical object, which, you know, you can think of me sending you the group element, even though it's a Lie group. And So in other words, consider the, you know, a code space which is spanned by basis states, mutually orthogonal, one corresponding to each element of the group. But it's a Lie group, so it's an exponential code space. I just send you the whole thing. And then even if, so I can send you a couple of copies, one of them gets erased, it's fine. You can still reconstruct the reference frame. Mm-hmm. So I think this is a clue that there should be a nice notion of an approximate Easton-Knill theorem.
And can you say again why approximate Easton-Knill theorem? It might be relevant for this proposal of having error correcting code.
Because the boundary dynamics is governed by some local Hamiltonian. So, you know, if you think about doing some Trotter approximation to that, you know, you can make the state evolve on the boundary by doing unitaries which factorize. But that's supposed to correspond to dynamics in the bulk. And in the bulk, you know, we're describing the evolving geometry as a state in a code space. So there should be a way to obtain evolution in the code space in a way that looks local acting on the physical qubits. I don't know, is that clear?
So what does the this would pertain more generically. I mean, what role would the CFT play?
Well, it's just, so let's accept that the right way of thinking about the dictionary is it's an encoding map of some error-correct encoding. And we think we should also be able to think of that as describing the low-energy sector of the CFT. Well, under the Hamiltonian evolution of the CFT, the low-energy sector is preserved. Evolve according to Hamiltonian, you don't change the energy. So the dynamics of the CFT should preserve the code space. And that is in tension because the boundary Hamiltonian is a local Hamiltonian, which is Eastern Canal obstruction. And to figure out how it fits together.
More questions related to this or anything else?
So this is related to this. I don't know quite how to phrase it, but based bulk geometry is somehow some coarse graining of something, presumably, somehow emerges. But is this coarse graining most, I mean, one way to think of it is this code subspace.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not a, I mean, it's not clear whether you're supposed to think of it as somehow maybe some other type of enveloping, not just say tracing out of some other part of the, say all the UV stuff you don't see out of a Hilbert space and describe that by a density matrix. It might be much more general. It might be some little bit of a time average thing, or it might be not a splittage, not a sort of trace out of things. And it's not clear to me whether, I mean, what is the best framework to think about the classical geometry? What sort of an object is it in the full CFT Hilbert space, which we might equate with the full quantum gravity bulk Hilbert space? The classical geometry part is some core structure within that, but what exactly is that structure?
So you want a framework for understanding classical geometry in the CFC description, or?
Yes,
yeah,
or
okay.
We don't have the quantum gravity, but that's...
Yes,
I
even
mean,
the... Okay,
yeah.
Uh-huh. Jonathan.
I'd like to understand some kind of what appears to be non-linearities in ADS CFT. So if I look at, like, the notion there is that max mean tangled states can represent, say, like, W-sided wormholes, whereas product states represent disconnected spacetimes, and yet we know from quantum theory that we can write a density matrix in terms of one basis or the other, so that appears kind of strange. I guess a few people have written about this, but I would like to me that seems like it should be a problem, and I guess I would like to understand why people who do...
Wait, I didn't understand. Can you explain again the nonlinearity? What it is?
So like the maximally entangled state
in
the CFT, between two CFTs, is meant to represent in a CFT the thermofield double state, a very highly entangled state in the CFT is meant to represent the double-sided
wormhole.
So there's a wormhole. And I can look at many such states, and they should all represent doubly-sided black holes.
You mean many maximum entangled states? For
many maximum entangled.
If you put some unitary here, would...
I just time evolve one side,
uh-huh,
and that just changes the phases, but also because it just involves time evolution on one side, nothing, you don't expect anything horrible.
So the bulk description is still the same, you say? That's
one would expect that.
Okay, uh-huh.
Yet if I mix many of such these states, I'll get a state which I could write in a product basis.
Like a maximum mixed state, right, if you mix...
Or, yeah, a maximum correlated state even.
Uh-huh.
And that ought to represent, as I understand it, states which are disconnected. And so it appears that there's kind of a... In quantum mechanics, we expect that these two descriptions should be the same, but in the bulk, you would think you could distinguish them. And a number of people have written about it, but as far as I can see, I don't think there's a very satisfying solution to this problem. It's hard for me to describe in a short time, but I'm mm-hmm. very interested in talking to people, and
okay.
I don't know if there's anyone else who's interested in this. I'd be very interested in kind of understanding of it.
Can that depend on the observer? Can't you see it as a statement which just depends on the observer? If you know what your phases are between your two CFTs, then you actually have access to the wormhole. Otherwise,
it seemed that there's an experiment you can do where you just jump into the black hole and you don't need to know which state you're in, and if you have a disconnected space-time, you think you would hit a firewall or something, and if you have a connected space-time, you should go smoothly through the horizon. So, to me, it seems to be a problem. I think Joe knows a fair bit about this, and I see he's nodding, so. Maybe he has some ideas.
About the idea of using error correction for the bulk boundary correspondence, I was wondering what the link with randomization because the coarse graining, because the idea is as well, the coarse graining of the boundary. And this would suggest another way of using error correction for the correspondence, where the boundary, to get the boundary from bulk, you have to reconstruct the evolution removed by the coarse graining. But this picture is very orthogonal to the way that correction is used in these models. So I was wondering how the picture might be.
So what the you say the boundary is a coarse graining of the bulk?
Well, the idea that the bulk is a coarse graining of the boundary. That the bulk direction is kind of a large scale.
Right.
Well, it doesn't necessarily mean that it has to do with coarse graining, but largely can be thought of either as coarse graining or a scaling. But usually when you do scaling, you also keep a cutoff, so you have to show the graining as well.
Uh-huh.
And that's kind of an error. I mean, when you coarse grain, you destroy some information, right?
Yes.
And so, well, so basically, how does this picture interact with the quaternary correction picture? So,
right.
Or when it is emerging from this error correction point of view.
I don't think I agree with the statement that the bulk is a coarse graining of the boundary. I mean, the duality says the two descriptions are equivalent. So there should be as much information on both sides. What we usually do is to think of the bulk is classical or semi-classical. So that's the approximation in which, you know, there's some, maybe there's some loss of information or some.
So maybe it's, maybe one has to first answer the other question that, which is, how does the classical picture emerge?
The classical bulk geometry. I mean, here's a conjecture, a wild conjecture that perhaps the bulk classical geometry might be best thought as some, you know, pointer basis type state that's been unselected, and all that you can see about the bulk geometry are, you know, are things that are, you know, quantum Darwinistically redundant or something like that, that you don't really have generically, you know, access to the full state. That's one of the actually questions that I would be very interested in, sort of, frankly, you know, that's what people understand.
Yes, I don't know about this, much about this RG idea, but I mean, I just read that in the literature people think of, of this vibration as a large scale, so I don't know how it's connected.
But that's slightly different. So already the classical bulk geometry is everywhere through the bulk. And in the, from the bulk standpoint, you don't really, it's not meaningful to ask how far or closer to the boundary. Now, there's a separate thing where you have the bulk radial direction that, roughly speaking, you know, corresponds to the scale. And so you could think of the RG within the field theory as flowing sort of inward into the bulk. But that's not, that's a different level of saying, different set of statements than saying, well, if you're only asking about the bulk geometry everywhere, you're already ignoring some, you know, quantum gravitational microscopics that are not described just in terms of the classical geometry.
Yeah.
And I thought what you said was more analogous to bulk RG, not boundary RG. Because you could talk about low energy states in bulk. That is a sector which can be thought of as the coarse graining of the whole system. So that maybe answers Aaron's question.
I see.
And then you can talk about different energy scales in the bulk. And you can describe different code subspaces depending on the choice of the cutoff.
But bulk RG is not just
it's a not that. Thing. It's not, no, it's like choosing gut scale or some high energy cutoff scale in the bulk. That's something you can do, and that will choose, depending on that, you will choose this bigger or larger or smaller code subspace out of the four Hilbert space. So I agree that I wouldn't call the bulk as the coarse graining of the boundary, but the low energy sector of the bulk can be thought of as a coarse graining of the whole system.
Well, simply because you're coarse graining.
Right. Yes. Simply because of that. Yes.
Nobody's asking about the quantum thermodynamics and foundations. One could ask things like, is there a arrow of time when you're in thermal equilibrium, or do you isolate when you're in thermal equilibrium?
Okay, always, yeah, it's always.
And this is, you might ask also within the holography side, if you have a black hole like geometry that's sort of thermalized, is that in this sense most generic? I mean, it still feels like there's, to the extent that, I was just fantasizing that maybe you have the classical bulk geometry, some unselected state, what would that then tell you if there weren't an unselection going on, because that seems naively to contradict that you do have a classical bulk geometry. How does that classical bulk geometry of a black hole, why is that so different from a classical geometry of a pure radius, which both seem to be, again, because they're classical geometries, they both seem to be some coarse graining over the quantum gravitational stuff. And yet, one of them is thought to be the unique vacuum of the CFT, whereas the other one is the thermal ensemble. So from the CFT side, they look very different. Which, again, I think this is all interrelated, so I'm not sure where I would put it, but I think those are questions I'd like to press over.
Anyone else?
Yes. This is quantum foundation. This is still empty. So in quantum foundation, recently there has been a lot of attempts to find information theoretic principles for foundations of quantum mechanics that do not start, for example, with the axioms like Hilbert space. So start with axioms which are more information theoretic. But on the other hand, there are in quantum gravity. Or string theory, people sometimes claim that you can't understand quantum mechanics independent of gravity. I mean, the quantum mechanics makes sense only when you have a theory of gravity. I just want to see if there's any evidence for this, or if there's any strong argument that you need gravity to understand foundations of quantum mechanics. Sorry?
Yeah. Are you talking about Penrose's idea of collapse of the wave function?
Penrose or Susskind recently had this paper. I'm just curious to understand why they have this claim, and I don't understand them. I thought maybe people here can help me understand that gravity is relevant for understanding foundations of quantum mechanics.
But like the collapse of the wave function, the measurement problem, or?
Or, yeah, maybe that's part of the... I don't understand the claims. I thought maybe people here can help me to understand.
Uh-huh.
That wasn't the subject of the, I don't think, of the Susskind paper. That was, well, you know, the GR equals QM paper.
Yeah.
That's what you're, which is sort of extending ER equals EPR.
So I don't understand that. I thought maybe people can explain more.
Hey, it looks like a good foundation question, right? So, I have one open question, which is so about quantum error correction as well. So we know quantum error correction plays an important role here, right? Because of topological other systems, right? So we can have these many-body models for which the ground state is degenerate, and because of like the topology of the system, they'll form a quantum error correcting code, like Tory code and fractional quantum Hall state and so on. Here, right, we just recently, this seems to be very relevant, right, to understand holography. And again, now they emerge in a different way. They're emerging as these low-lying excited states of a conformal field theory, right? And what I've been thinking about, and also with Burak and Elizabeth Cross from the Caltech, is whether there is a relation, they're also relevant here, or maybe he should put statistical mechanics as well. And the idea is whether quantum error correcting, correcting codes or quantum error correction is related to chaos, to quantum chaos, and in particular to the eigenstate formalization hypothesis. So one thing that is easy to check is that one of the conditions of the eigenstate formalization hypothesis, there is many ways to formulate it, there is a particular one, which is actually equivalent to the eigenstates forming an approximate quantum error correcting code, right? So so that's intriguing. And then you can ask what is, right, what is the significance of that, right? Can we, does this imply anything? Can we, instead of thinking of ETH the way we usually think, if we think in terms of the coding perspective, does it bring anything new, right, to the study of these problems? And we can think more generally, which is what we are doing, which is really about chaos, or is something more? Like, if you have some other, how generically do we have quantum error correcting codes in the eigenstates of many-body models, right? So we have three different examples, I think, like ETH is one. This topological other systems is another one in the ground state. They generate ground states of topologically other systems. And low-lying, right, energy eigenstates of CFTs or holographic dual. No, there's three different examples, and it's hard to find a unifying right theory for these cases. So I think that's an interesting problem I'd like to think more about in this time period.
Okay, so a question and a comment or suggestion. Yes. So the question is, I can see, I guess, where you're coming from, but I mean, you think quantum error correction and chaos would be diametric opposites, right? Chaos, you get rapid loss of information. Quantum error correction,
yes,
you get preserved information. Okay, so this gets to, it's just based on this condition that you're saying that. So the comment is, the unifying theme to me is maybe just that generic subspaces are quantum error correcting codes, or at least approximate mm-hmm. quantum error correcting codes. And in the case of the thermodynamics, it's clear that that's the connection.
The reason behind, yes.
Right. Whether it has a deeper meaning or not, that's a separate issue. In the other two cases, you're definitely using non-generic subspaces, but again, to the extent that there are, I don't quite know the way to phrase it, but you're not picking them randomly, but you're not, they're not chosen not to be error-correcting codes either. So maybe in that sense, it's not so surprising that they are.
But in thermodynamics, I'm not sure if I completely agree, because, okay, one thing, if you take a large subspace and if you take like states at random there, they are great codes, if the subspace is big enough. That's true. But it's something more, right? This is a condition about the eigenstates of a many-body Hamiltonian,
yeah,
right? And they will be the code words, right?
Yeah.
So there is not, there is more related to quantum chaos, I think, that there is all these ideas that how to prove that the eigenstate, they would mimic properties of random states, right?
Yeah. Exactly.
But there's a deeper reason behind it, right? It's just not like picking it at random code words from a large dimensional space, right?
Yeah, so not literally random code words, but
yeah.
But I mean, if you think that they behave like random states or random subspaces, then
yeah,
then you have the connection already in that sense.
Yeah. Isn't there an element that maybe I don't understand what being a quantum error correcting code is? Isn't there an element of not wanting everything to be part of it?
I mean, we have an echo definition, right? So we want to encode a qubit there into orthogonal states. And then you have local errors there. We should be able to recover the information in the end, right? So it's like, this excludes most quantum states, right? But it's,
so
but it's still...
What's the encoded thing here?
What's the recovery?
Oh, no, the recovery is...
If I usually think of a quantum chaotic system as soon as I hit it with a hammer.
Oh, that's the thing, so...
Maybe the point is this, that for exact quantum error correction, you have an exact duality between not having information on one subdivision, one tensor factor, and having complete information on the other. So, you know, if you have something where kind of information is lost in some part of the system, that means that you can should be able to recover it in the rest of it. For approximate, it's not quite as tight a connection. But sorry, I forgot where the question started. But that I think is the relevant factor here.
Then what decides just measuring the temperature here or here or here in equilibrium could be the object that you would try to correct or recover in the ETH context?
No, I think this is an interesting question, but what I mean here is something more specific. I just mean that if you take two eigenstates of Hamiltonian, which satisfies ETH, okay, and they have nearby energies, then if you have like local errors here, this quantum information encoding the superposition states preserved, you can decode it. Now it's very, very different from like having some information locally and then applying the Hamiltonian, which has a chaotic Hamiltonian, like and try to use the dynamics to do some kind of error correction. We should have access to the eigenstates of the model, which is similar here, right? Which is similar to this case here. So the claim here is not that the CFTs they are actually useful in protecting quantum information, right? As is the case for topological odysseys, but at least it's not clear. So that's one of the open questions here, right? So this approximate quantum error correcting codes, they appear here in these two cases, but in a more subtle way than like for topological other systems, because the fact that they are the ground states, they really help you to encode and decode information, whereas C is not clear how to do it. So it's...
So here you're taking the states from some chaotic Hamiltonian, but then you throw the Hamiltonian out.
That's right. So we just the statement just that you take the code words as the eigenstates of the nearby Hamiltonian, but you don't think about the dynamics anymore. Yeah. It's a static observation, right? The eigenstates form a quantum error correction code.
Yeah. It almost seems like, I mean, from the computer science, you think you have some small system, you want to encode it in some larger auxiliary system. And use that for decoding correcting the errors. Whereas in the holography, you have a larger system and you want to reduce the amount, the information that is sort of decodable in the course of this. Is that, would you characterize it that way in the statements that you were saying before? Just sort of paraphrasing the. I mean, it sounds like in holography, you already have the larger space, and then the code subspace is the thing that's sort of most important about geometry, as long as you don't get excited with some large energies and stuff. But so it's an opposite mindset in these two contexts where quantum error correction is evoked.
Maybe I think about holography is that because you have this isometry from the bulk to the boundary, right? This is how the information gets encoded into the code, right? So it's like some local observer in the bulk gets mapped there, yes. That's right. Whereas here we don't know anything like that, right? There's like, yeah, so. Yeah, I agree. This is like the least understood, but just the question is whether there is something more to it or it's just, right, a coincidence. And that's it. Question. John.
Well, I thought Rob Myers would have said something by now, but he hasn't. So there's a natural, there's a question that combines two and four that has drawn attention lately. in the context of what's the connection between a complexity and geometry, in particular the complexity action conjecture. And this also gives one kind of a new way of looking at quantum chaos, as Susskind and Brown have recently emphasized. If you think about the evolution, not with respect to the usual Hilbert space geometry, but a kind of complexity geometry, where states are far apart if it takes a long quantum computation to get from one to the other. So the question is, you know, is there some natural, beautiful way of defining this complexity geometry, which would allow one to make these connections more precise? I mean, so far, I think people have made attempts, but they seem rather ad hoc, and there should be some more beautiful way of formulating things.
Yeah,
Jeff?
Rob has something to add here, or question related to that? You don't have to. So of course, go make it, but you can tell later, too. Link.
I guess related to this, is there some physical interpretation for the notion of gate set choice? So any notion of complexity is defined with respect to a specific choice of gate set. So in order to make sense of something like complexity equals action conjecture, we need some sort of physical notion of gate set choice, such that we know which complexity we're talking about in the context of the boundary theory. In particular, is the physical interpretation of gate set choice something like your choice of gauge fixing? Because in some sense, your there are similarities here, where your choice for gates and your choice for gauge are both in some sense local constraints that you put onto your thing, and the idea is that your final answer, whether it's your unitary evolution or whether it's the specific computation you're making, should be independent of your choice of gauge or your choice of gate set. It's just that certain things will be easier with certain choices than others. And so if one can understand the physical interpretation of gate set choice, then I think it would bring complexity equals action and conjectures like that one step closer to falsifiability, where you can actually decide if it's correct.
But it's not, I mean, complexity is dependent on the gate set choice. Right? If you chose gates that are sort of arbitrary, unitary, then you have no complexity.
Right, but the question, I guess, is there some natural choice of gate set? And is the natural choice of gate set somehow motivated by the physical interpretation of what a gate set choice is?
I mean the exact value of the complexity is dependent on the gate set choice. And computer scientists, you normally deal with this issue by saying, well, we're not interested in the exact value. That's not a very meaningful thing. We're interested in the scaling at large sizes. And maybe even, you know, the scaling only up to polynomials, or if you're more strict, log factors or something like that. So is there a way to make that same kind of...
like a k-locality?
Yeah, like this, I mean, there's like some class of different choices that are all pretty similar, but they differ in the details, and somehow the thing that's meaningful is the class rather than the specific thing inside the class. I mean, I don't know how that would, I can't imagine, honestly, how that would make it possible to do the complexity versus action thing, but maybe there's some way.
Are you saying something like, is there some equivalent to Solovic type?
No, well,
I guess you want your complexity classes to be gate set independent, otherwise.
Yeah, I mean, so complexity theorists like to pick classes that are robust against relatively small details, like, you know, what's the gate set that you have,
of course.
Or you know, what's the exact probability cutoff that you put in, things like that. If you had a class that's not robust against that basis, it's not a very good class. So the question is there a way to make this kind of a more robust notion, I guess, so that these details about how you define it don't matter?
Right, so that might also depend on a change in your definition on your gravity side.
Yeah.
Because, like, the action is not, something that depends on how you...
Although, I mean, you can add a constant to it, right, and that doesn't matter, right?
but it's hard to imagine how you might multiply it by a log factor.
Yeah, that's my primary.
The interesting thing is the complexity equals the action proposal specifies a particular normalization constant for complexity. They're very precise about the coefficient that they chose. So I wonder what that means from the either the gate set point of view or the CFT perspective.
This was to saturate the Lloyd bundle.
It's related to that.
What I was going to say is that up till now, the holographers are asking more refined questions. We're not trying to distinguish polynomial from exponential, and so we're trying to. What we're finding is by looking at different examples, there are sort of general scalings or general properties. But it seems to be a much more refined question that we're studying, at least at the present time.
Yeah, this is why I can't see how to make
it. Yeah, no, okay, okay, yeah.
All right, so far, you know, we haven't really put black holes on the board. So I think that's sort of a major focus of a lot of us gravitational physicists. I'd like to know, is there an information theoretic description of a black hole, or an analog of a black hole, or what does a black hole look like in information, quantum information terms? Or something like that?
What do you mean?
What do I mean?
That's the question.
It's a good question. I mean, so one specific thing that's come out is this notion of chaos. So it's been shown that black holes and somehow maximize the exponent for chaos, and that means that these dual CFTs, if they have a holographic description, must always, in some sense, be maximally, you know, quantum chaotic as a property of having a gravitational dual. So that's one property of a quantum field theory that, in some sense, is necessary to have a black hole description. But maybe there is more. More abstract, more some quantum information.
So in this statement, in the last statement you made, you didn't actually need the presence of the black hole to be there, just the possibility of a black hole, the fact that in gravity it could collapse a black hole.
Well, sure. I mean, the quantum CFT has other states which don't have black holes in them. So that's true.
So it wasn't like a black hole detect. I mean, you tap the CFT and that property of it, the way of the exponent and stuff, is not really a black hole detector.
It's not a black hole detector. I mean, of course, we think of black holes as somehow, you know, these thermal equilibrium states that certainly high temperature. A lot of out of equilibrium properties and, you know, processes involving black holes. So, I mean, I don't know, in some sense, maybe you'll tell me we can't address this question until we address earlier questions about how you get the classical geometry out of the CFT, maybe in a more better way. But
also, when you're saying maximally chaotic, isn't that sort of frame dependent, basically?
Well,
what do you mean by maximally chaotic?
There's this exponent that you know, Douglas Stanford and Wong and people. I mean, they proved a bound on how fast, you know, chaos can. I mean, how fast, you know, these things can grow in a quantum system and black hole saturated.
You can formulate the time scales as proper times, right? Based on that's a geometrical. What frame?
Well, it's sort of one way of thinking about it. It's, you know, it's tied to the outside description, mm-hmm. you know, versus the description that is observers crossing the horizon. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in that sense, it's, you know, it's frame
then
that
it
comes from. What's that?
Then it would be even.
I see. So I think it's the binary choice about whether you're an infalling observer or somebody who stays outside.
Well, at least that's one aspect of the frame dependence. You know, in some sense, you
you might see something that looks chaotic from the point of view of the outside observer, but not so chaotic from the point of view of another frame, say, attached to a top observer.
Think about the outside observer.
Okay, on the topic of black holes, of course, one of the things that's been a mystery is how the black hole interior is encoded in the CFT. And we may have a useful hint about that in this recent work on traversable wormholes, where it seems, at least you couple the two CFTs together in the thermal field double state, it's possible for observer to pass through the wormhole and survive and tell about it. And so, information about what is experienced in the interior is somehow available. And this is it's kind of a form of teleportation that's going on. And I'm not sure we've quite, from the quantum information point of view, have you formulated that in the cleanest possible way. Just from the pure quantum information setting, what's really going on when we can teleport information through a wormhole?
Are you saying, if you abstract away all the quantum gravity, there is some protocol that looks like teleportation that we don't understand, or it's... What is the relation with teleportation?
Well, you're coupling together two CFTs. And so that's actually a quantum wire connecting the two, but it means there's communication between the sender and the receiver, and that's somehow what's making it possible for quantum information to get transported. And if you break the wire, then you can't get through the wormhole. Right? So there's communication between Alice and Bob is needed to send the information through. It's teleportation in that sense.
I see.
Is this how is this different from Conniston's question?
Sorry?
Yours was also about the
bubble. About non-linearity, right?
Yeah, I don't think there's much relationship.
Okay. I mean, because non-linearities can have communication, right?
Yeah, but here they get the information out of every couple of two CFTs. They come to introduce a couple, a non-linear coupling. You're talking about the Aaron Wall, this stuff with Aaron Wall, John.
Right. Okay. Good. Anyone else? Pink?
I guess just in the ADS-CFT side, how does one construct ADS-CFT? One question that you could ask is if the strong version of ER-EPR is correct, and all forms of entanglement are precisely dual to wormholes, even quantum wormholes, which I'm not really sure how to describe. Can you, in some sense, reconstruct the ADS-CFT bulk by thinking of it as stitching together a bunch of pairs or entuplets of qubits that are linked to each other via some sort of multi-boundary quantum wormhole? And then by, summing over all of them, build something that looks like normal ADS-CFT, if we're doing really open questions.
I mean, I don't know what a quantum wormhole is.
I don't either. But
there's a lot of physics in ADS-CFT that doesn't involve wormholes. I mean, you can imagine all sorts of graviton scattering, problems in ADS, non-trivial metrics and time dependence, and that's all described by evolution in the dual CFT in a way that doesn't obviously involve any wormholes.
Yeah, I'm just trying to make sense of the following word algebra argument, which could be problematic because it's word algebraic. But if entanglement emerges space-time, and if all entanglement can be described as wormholes, then can we think about how the microscopic wormholes emerge space-time? Like, that's the question that, if those equalities or implications are correct, then this is a question that you can ask.
connected question. Has anyone looked at this idea of equality in the context of loop quantum gravity?
Loop quantum gravity.
Where they have a model of space-time, which where this connection is almost direct, because they've got the area of the electron, which is the spectrum is genetic candidate to entanglement in the sense network in the spin network state. It might be an example of what you need to be for.
Maybe I'll say my previous question, or mention the previous question in a different way, because a lot of people bring up E R equals EPR or entanglement as geometry. I guess it seems to me there's a big tension between how people quantum information think about entanglement, which is it's not a kind of stuff, it's not an objective thing. I can mix a bunch of entangled states and get a product state. And so when people in string theory kind of talk about geometry emerging from entanglement, it seems difficult from a quantum information person to think what that could possibly mean, because entanglement isn't a kind of stuff. Like, I think geometry is a kind of objective thing. So that's the tension.
You need some prior structure to define entanglement, right, on your Hilbert space. Presumably, like, a notion of subsystem actually.
Sure.
So in some sense, you might think that's a little more analogous to the geometry structure you're putting in to begin with.
Sure. But when I start to think of, does geometry emerge from entanglement? And I think there seems to be I think that there's issues around that, and that's can be really problematic. It seems to me to be really problematic, actually.
But if you specify the state and the, let's say, bipartitioning, you can just describe, okay, what is the entanglement entropy of the one side that's a well-defined quantity,
I don't think it is. I mean, entropy is a well-defined quantity, but it's not an observable. Entanglement isn't the kind of thing like that you can observe in the same way that you can observe other things.
But does that have to be, why should that be a requirement for it to be observable? Why should one require it to be an observable for equating it with something physical?
It may not have to be, but I feel that it's something that kind of is missing a bit in the discussion.
Maybe related, probably geometry is not observable for all states in the Hilbert space.
Sure.
And once you restrict to, a subspace of states, then there are certainly quantum error-correcting models where you see entanglement in that subspace becomes approximately observable through some Rutherg analysis formula. So even though it's not observable in the full Hilbert space, for a set of states, it behaves like some area operator plus corrections. So I think that example makes, at least in that context, resolves the tension.
Yeah, I've heard
does it create the tension? Because you'd say, okay, well, for this restricted set of states, they're the same.
Yes.
But the conjecture then is that it holds beyond that restricted set of states, and that's where you get the conflict, right? So how can that be? Because now you have an observable sort of thing on one side and a non-observable sort of thing on the other.
Geometry is not observable outside of closed subspace.
Okay, I guess that's what I'm saying.
Is there a way we can disprove ER equals EPR?
How do we make it a testable statement, and what kinds of tests do we use?
I guess I've done a little bit of stuff thinking about that sort of thing. One thing that you might want to demand of something like ER-EPR is that if it's going to be true, then something that is a known no-go theorem in quantum mechanics on the EPR side had better map to a known no-go theorem on the GR side, meaning that I shouldn't have an instance where I have a case where, for example, I have something like the no-cloning theorem on the quantum mechanics side, and have the ER-EPR dual of that somehow be a totally valid classical geometry. In particular, if you take a look at what the no-cloning theorem maps to, it actually maps to things that relate to whether or not your space-time manifold is Hausdorff in the GR center. So like there are these kinds of necessary but certainly not sufficient tests that one can do, where one can ask the question of, if we make some assumption about what the precise meaning of ER-EPR is, does it or does it not map pathologies to pathologies and non-pathologies to non-pathologies? So these are a class of questions that one can ask. It's just one can't go far enough to prove ER-EPR in this way, but one can test it.
And so one thing that might help is we do know about certain topology-changing transitions in quantum gravity, where you go from having a connected spacetime to having that part of the spacetime disconnect. And we understand what the order parameter is at some level. So that would have to mesh with the conjecture and have to change the entanglement structure. I don't know the contradiction.
You motivated it in the first place.
Pardon?
That sort of thing motivated
what, the transition?
Over at
his marks. Well, pair production of black holes was connected with Einstein-Rosen and Friedrich, for example, part of the motivation.
Okay, I have in mind more for okay. Like a winding condenses and that causes a transition. So
that was the matter.
The tachyons.
Yeah. And that we can, you know, relate to Wilson line condensation or something in the dual theory. So. There's no contradiction, but it would have to change the entanglement structure accordingly.
Yeah,
anything else?
So going back to the Ning's point, is there some kind of like monogamy of wormholes?
Are you asking the answer is yes. So what you can think of is, this is kind of what we did. So like you can start with one wormhole and you can ask, what does the holographic dual of cloning one of the mouths of the wormhole look like? Well, this clone, if the original mouth was labeled B, I can call this one B prime. The entanglement structure between A and B prime and A and B should be exactly the same. So that means that the wormhole connecting them should look exactly the same, but also there should be no connection between B and B prime. The problem that this leads to is that if you have, there now exists certain sets of geodesics that enter A which must bifurcate, because you don't know, and in fact they must somehow end in both B and B prime. And this is something that is forbidden in GR by something called the Hausdorff condition. So like, this is a way, at least in the limit of classical wormholes, that you can have something that looks like monogamy of wormholes.
How would you place in that context a multi-boundary?
Exactly. Oh yeah, so if you have a geodesic that goes into a multi-boundary geometry, then like in the interior of the geometry, if I start a geodesic at one point with a specific angle, it'll end in a definite place. Mm-hmm. Right, so the problem with this statement here is that another way to say this is that there is entanglement in a multi-boundary geometry between the B and B prime mouths. Whereas if you exactly clone B prime from B, there should be no entanglement between the B and B prime mouths. There should not be a bulk path that connects them. Mm-hmm. And so that's the difference with the multi-boundary wormhole case. Because the multi-boundary wormhole case, if A and B are connected, and if A and B prime are connected, then B and B prime need to be connected in bulk.
So kind of think of a multi-boundary wormhole as a I have B and B primed and an EPR pairs to some system that's like four-dimensional. Is that what the dual of the multi-boundary wormhole is?
The dual of the multi-boundary wormhole case is a situation where you have some number of conformal field theories that are each defined on complete boundaries, and there's non-trivial entanglement between, I guess, any pair of conformal boundaries.
Mm-hmm. But the individual ones are not entangled with each other. If I trace out a...
Yeah, so that's actually a hard question to answer. Because it's pretty unclear what the holographic interpretation of tracing out an entire boundary means.
So more broadly, I'd like to understand what information theoretic ways that we can use to describe when a theory has a gravity dual or semi-classical gravity dual. And even more, what kind of states describe a wormhole besides entanglement? Can there be other structure of the states which are important in getting a semi-classical wormhole?
Do we know any such? Do we know any such criteria?
One thing I can think of, which are only necessary conditions, far from being maybe not sufficient, is these holographic entropy cones.
Uh-huh.
They are necessary conditions for the theory to have an Einstein gravity dual, because you can prove that any such theory would satisfy these additional entropy inequalities.
So there's two sets of questions. One is what theories admit a holographic dual, but then within those theories, that's the first question.
Mm-hmm.
Then the second question that sort of the partial answers, the entropic cone is,
yes,
within such theories, which states correspond to classical geometry.
Uh-huh.
There is a second question, yes. Entropy cone could also be the question. Could also be a necessary condition for the first question if you consider just vacuum state.
Okay, fair
enough.
And the second question is more like maybe a way of deriving ER equals EPR based on what conditions we can have for a semi-classical wormhole. So
mm-hmm.
we don't understand quantum wormholes, but what conditions we can use to get semi-classical ones.
So Xu, I would actually separate that condition a little bit differently. I would say that there's as you say, there are a set of constraints on states and a set of constraints on theories.
Yes.
And I would say that the set of constraints on theories are more like the HPPS condition, like things about like you need some sort of sparse low-lying spectrum, large central charge, things like that. And I would say that the entropy inequalities are solely a constraint on what states within the theory
are
allowed to
people. In general, I agree. I was just saying that the second thing can also be thought of as necessary conditions for the theory to be holographic, because you can apply it to particular states that you know. If the theory is holographic, it must be dual to a pure ABS.
So you can refine this set of questions further to ask, okay, suppose you're within one of these states in a theory with a holographic dual where the state itself has a geometrical description. We should, by the way, have a name for these things, G state or something. That would be easy thing to say. But such states, you might then ask, of course, how do you recover then the bulk from the CFD data, but more as a more refined question, you might ask, suppose you just know the state at a single instant of time, and you don't know the Hamiltonian, the boundary Hamiltonian, the CFD Hamiltonian, is there a definite region in the bulk which this recovers? Then you can ask even more refined question that people adopt the sub-region duality, if you have just a restricted amount of information about the state, where you trace over stuff you don't know the state only in a given spatial region, so you have the reduced density matrix. Is there then a bulk region which this allows you to recover? Here, typically, people allow the assumption we know the boundary Hamiltonian and the conjecture that has been motivated in various different ways recently through sort of, on the one hand, quantum error correction and modular Hamiltonian, on the other hand, by sort of these recovery channels, is that it's the entanglement wedge in the bulk that's the dual to this reduced density matrix. But that itself has lots of puzzles associated with it. For example, we have a phase transitions in that spatial region or space-time region under small deformations of the entangling surface, which seems a bit mysterious. You can have these entanglement wedges probe inside of black holes, including the curvature singularity. And so many of these questions, it would be nice to sort of push this reconstruction, this bulk reconstruction proposal further to address exactly how do you resolve the black hole singularity using this formula from the CFT standpoint and so forth. So, I mean, just to write, you know, subregion duality or something summarizes that set of questions.
Good. We still have like 10 minutes if there's anything else.
Yeah, I have one more. And you to any participants?
Well, I just wanted to comment that it would be nice if we could broaden the question of what theories have gravitational duals beyond CFTs. In particular, you know, we'd like to understand the asymptotically flat case and de Sitter space. And it may be that the ideas about quantum error correction can kind of lead us in the right direction if we can identify some code subspace of the Hilbert space which can be associated with some kind of dual geometry. Maybe that could be very helpful. And so there's one concrete question I have. Maybe somebody has a good answer to this. Subir talked on Monday about the SYK model. And it has this very interesting low-lying spectrum where there's an exponential density of states at low energy, and it has an emergent geometry. It's not a coincidence that it has both these things. So if we could, in what sense can we think of those, that low-lying spectrum as code space? Protected against some kind of errors, I'm not sure what. And, maybe that can help one flesh out better. And it's the simplest example we have, so we should try to understand everything about it. How identifying a code space in the low-lying spectrum is correlated with some kind of emergent geometry. And, maybe that can be true for matrix models too, they're sort of morally similar, that in each case there isn't any geometry except for the emergent geometry. But what does that have to do with quantum error correction?
And how close do you think we're answering some of this?
Answer?
Yeah.
No. Not yet.
I have a sort of a metaphysics question, which is
foundations, maybe.
partly harking back to the complexity story, partly to this sort of computability. Are these things sort of telling us some new, principle of nature, say compactness of packaging the information, having to do something with sort of specifying the dynamics in physics or specifying set of allowed states, or is whether you can compute something in this quantum computer in polynomial time and the size of the problem, is that a criterion for nature? Is there a second law of complexity? Does that restrict dynamics of physical theories, those sorts of things? Why should physics, to put it provocatively, why should physics care about quantum computing?
Yes.
For example.
And that's a good question here, right, in this action equals complexity, because maybe the reason why the complexity is low for some dynamics is because there is a very ingenious algorithm for a task, right? Like maybe, the algorithm for linear programming. That's the reason why it's not exponential. It's polynomial instead of exponential. Does physics care about this? No, right? So that has to, there has to be more to it, right, than just complexity is very, the reason we don't understand it very well is because it's very different from the rest of physical thing in physics usually, right? And so okay, maybe we have to go there, but maybe there is something.
It's just a possible approximation. I mean, maybe it's not. Yeah, maybe you have to change the notion of complexity to make that connection. I mean, so for instance, going back to the very first question that I raised, there's this idea that these computationally hard problems could be like glassy systems. But there's definitely some glassy systems where there is an efficient algorithm. Like if you look at XORSAT, mm-hmm. So all of the constraints are basically linear equations. There is a solution that's efficient, but the behavior of the system as a physical system is still glassy. And people study it as a glassy system.
Right.
And it seems to me that if you want to make that connection, which still seems like a reasonable one to me, you have to restrict from complexity of all algorithms to complexity of some sort of local search algorithm or something like that. I don't know exactly what it would be. But it's not arbitrary algorithms anymore. Maybe that's, maybe you have to do something like that here, that it's kind of like a lot of algorithms would apply, but not all algorithms, mm-hmm. something like that. Or for that matter, maybe it's the other around. Maybe you have some extra computational ability that you don't normally put in a computer, right? Some many body thing.
Right. Oh, I think probably John was first.
I read about tying up things, maybe like the interface of complexity theory and quantum thermodynamics.
Uh-huh.
There's some work done, I think, about Wojtek, who's coming here, kind of thinking about Landau erasure and the Kolmogorov complexity of the states you're trying to erase. Kind of the difference between different kinds of entropy and complexity and what they mean.
So what is the question? Whether they're related in a way, or it's in weeks known that they are.
This kind of this interface. Part of this is the kind of this work of Adam Brown and many, and also just the work of Wojtek and kind of different understandings of what the second law, what the ordinary second law of thermodynamics mean, and those sorts of things. I think they're kind of tied to complexity theory in a lot of ways.
I see.
All right, since we don't have that many things under topic one, following up on glassy behavior, a question you could ask is whether there are quantum glasses that are without disorder that are translation invariant. And there's a candidate for that in the hot code, because although it has point-like excitations, they're not mobile. And actually, a couple of years ago, Ha and Kim argued that if you look at any finite energy state in the thermodynamic limit, it has a long relaxation time. But the question one wants to ask is what happens at, a non-zero temperature or some non-zero energy density. And I don't think that's known. It's an interesting intersection of codes and many body physics. Could be explored more.
There's a bunch of work on that problem. I just visited Boulder, and I think every one of their theorists is working on these kinds of models in the dynamics now.
Cool.
Which they call fractals. And they think that it's all eventually finite time and finite time. Well, okay, for the hot code. Yeah, also for the hot code, there's finite time and finite temperature relaxation, but with some sort of double, very long stretched exponential for that time scale.
That's the quantum memory problem, right? The paper by Bravi and Hart, right? They found this e to the beta square, I think.
Yeah, and then there's generalizations of
it. They show the same behavior. This was
similar behaviors in various other types of related models with non-mobile fractional excitations.
I see. But is that the same question as asking if it's a glass? I don't know.
Depends how you define glass.
Uh-huh.
It's
It's lower, yes. Yes.
So, the entire deal with talking about error correction in the context of holography came from analysis either in the infinite in classical limit or in the perturbative expansion. And I think that's kind of an elephant in the room, because actual quantum gravity does not have that limit. And it's an interesting question whether or not some form of a code space and error correction plays any role except in that limit, or if there's only an approximate story without taking that limit.
What's the limit again?
Oh, the the classical limit, infinite n.
But it's a naive question, but isn't the point here is that then we understand what the gravity theory is, right? How you phrase the question? Like you have some string theory and know whether for it there's a quantum error correction.
Yeah.
Even that's perturbative.
Yeah, you don't want perturbative. Okay, right. Yeah.
You can phrase the question in the CFT directly. No. That was a hard question.
So in ADS CFT, the CFT side usually comes with a gauge group of rank n, like SUN. And that parameter is like 1 over g, Newton's constant.
Okay, but then it's the dimension of SU.
1 over n is like the quantum correction.
Okay. How
the qubits behave differently when that is small qubit differences are.
Our time is up, but if there is a last question.
Well, we have to decide what to do with all this.
Well, we'll solve all of them, right? What we mean, like working groups and so on?
Yeah.
Right, this is one thing.
So, what are we doing on Friday? What do you guys want to do on Friday?
Right, we need feedback from you. So, in the structure that KITB suggested for us, we have discussion sessions twice a week, Wednesday and Friday. There are many ways we can do it. We did like this today, but of course, you're not going to do the same thing twice a week. So, we can either, please think about what you think would be useful and tell us. It can be like either some working groups on some particular topic and then people come here, or it can be maybe a bunch of us want to learn about some topic and then there is a good speaker here that could tell us about it, or just free time to discuss. So the structure is free, but we want input from you. So think about it and let us know, please.
Well, let us know soon, because...
Yeah, Friday is already, yeah, right. So Friday, yeah.
Now.
Does anyone have... Yeah, Jonathan.
I mean, I like the idea of people posing problems and then other people expressing an interest. I guess what happened here is people suggested problems, but it wasn't clear who might be interested in actually doing that. And so maybe it makes sense for people to put their hands up if they're interested in a particular thing. And that way, those people know, oh, this other person is interested in that and can arrange on their
own
to talk or not.
I mean, I hope what happens here is that, okay, so maybe some of these questions, you're interested in them and you remember who proposed them. So go to the person, talk to them, of course, right? Or we can use the wiki for that too. So on the wiki, we could maybe we should people who propose questions, they could go to the wiki and create a space for it, and there is space like for open questions there, and you could maybe phrase your open question and put your name, and that's a nice way to arrange to meet other people and form the working groups. I don't know.
How is everyone comfortable with that? Message of the
week. Yeah, that's true. Maybe no one lists the week. Then no one lists in the week. It's up to... I'm not going to write anything there. I'll just create the space, and whoever wants can go there and add the open questions or any other open questions. So it's just a space for open questions and offering topics.
Maybe a meeting time or so?
Sorry, say again.
If the open question could come with a meeting time, and we could put name and just show up. What is show up at that time? I can bring up.
Okay, yeah, we can do that. Yes.
I mean, do you guys prefer to break up the Friday slot into multiple sections, or as we said, so far there isn't a plan, so it's up to us what is best. I'm concerned that if we leave it for people to think about and give us feedback, nobody will say anything before Friday.
It's true.
Which is fine. We can not have anything unless somebody specifies.
Yeah, maybe an easier question is just what should we do on Friday? Forget about the following weeks.
<but. laughs> how many rooms are available on Friday?
It depends on the size. I mean, there's a couple of the small ones.
Because there are like, I don't know, there are one or two, maybe three clear kind of groupings of questions. So error correction, holography, transfer questions. More quantum gravity, ADS, CFT, specific more without the somewhat quantum information. Things about the facts. I mean, there's a few sort of clusters of questions.
It would be nice right. Not to overload them time wise. So.
Right, that's true.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe we design the barbecue tonight. And then we can think about it. But tell us what to do. Yeah, or I mean, we don't have to do anything on Friday if we right, don't want to. But if you think there's something meaningful to do, let us know. OK, thank you.